India and Lima in Peru. And it's a 3-year event. This is our poster from last year, from September, like that. Yeah. And it's organized, we officially are, from our side, we're NEOS, the North American Institute for Oriental and Classical Studies, incorporated in Tennessee. And on the other side, in Peru, we have an agreement with San Marcos University. I guess it can go right here. There you go. NEOS and San Marcos University. And San Marcos is the oldest university in the Western world. It started, I don't know, 15 something like that. And they have 45,000 students, internationally acclaimed in social sciences, law, medicine. So a very nice connection. It's taken us a long time to develop these programs. And this is part of this broader Bharatiya Sanskriti, or Festival of Classical Indian Culture, which includes ladies' fashion show, gustatory, cuisine, taste of the food, drama, and then a lot of academic sections in literature, ecology, education, all from a classical Indian perspective. So I'm going to try and follow the... This is about half done, see, because your piss is free, right? So don't expect too much, right? You get what you pay for. So I'm still working on this because it has to be presented at the university there as an accredited course in March. So we're developing. This is this. I'll show you. Okay, so there's the North American Institute. We did that. Here's the San Marcos University. And this is the poster that we're using there to advertise the event. And I think it's going to touch this here. So it's going to go on a Friday morning. We'll start on March 9th. And it's 3 hours with three sections. One is, the first one is called Sankhya. So Sankhya is the traditional Asian Vedic analysis of nature. Sankhya means to divide or analyze. So cosmology, what is this world? Who are we? How are we related? What is the mind? What is sense perception? What is the cause behind these things like that? So this is one philosophy of nature. What is physical reality? And we get into the title, How Cats See Ghosts, right? It's bound to attract somebody. And the second hour is actually application of these the Sankhya in specific scientific applications. In the Vedas, architecture is called Vastu, part of architecture. And then music and dance is called Gandharva Veda. And what else? Physical sciences is called Yantra Vidhi, medicine, Ayurveda. So it's a very, very complete, perspective on nature. And then after that, we'll have a cultural program with some songs and music from the 15th century. On the next day, Saturday then, that's interesting. Yeah. Which will be our next program next week. We're going to present then 3 Minutes with a Genius. So we'll explain that later. But Rupa Goswami and his followers from Bengal, from the 15th, 16th century, dominated the world of metaphysics. He wrote 18,000 verses and some 11,000 verses and summarized everything in 11 verses like that. And so we're going to have next week 3 minutes. That's what it takes to read those 11 verses. 3 minutes with a genius. So be sure and come next week. And also then the caste system and social philosophy. This is philosophy of nature. This is social philosophy. And so because it's on philosophy of nature, it says, is the caste system physically natural or unnatural? Is it a natural thing you find amongst people or not? And then finally, we're finishing off with a drama, cultural program, which is the Mahabharata, which is India's greatest classic. And a lot of Peruvian actors and directors help us produce it for this last festival, like that. And so now we have it as a 45-minute movie. So what we're getting today is just this, our developing program, How Cats See Ghosts. And for the actual program, we're going to bring a cat. Cat is sitting there, which, by the way, changes the whole atmosphere, no? Why is there a cat in the school? Are you matriculated? So I was born, a little bit about me then, I was born on Guam in the Marianas Islands, and it's Japan. So my parents were there at the end of World War II, and I was born there. It seems to have influenced my nature. But then right away we went, to San Francisco. Right. So I grew up in Arizona and Southern California. Then I went to the university. Went to the University of California, and I started electrical engineering, changed to biological engineering, and graduated in psychology. I got a first place prize that year, and Phi Beta Kappa is still around. Okay, so I got elected that. So I finished that off. I had to graduate, so I graduated in psychology, and then. Oh yeah, I went to a graduate school in Chicago at Northwestern University. And my mentor for the PhD was Donald Campbell. He was president of the American Psychological Association. He was a genius. Oh, incredible. Yeah. And so I came there, I started my work. Actually, the person I was going to work with was one lady, Viola Spolin. She wrote a book called Improvisation for the Theater. Was just published then, but since then it's been in reprint continuously. It's all theater games. It's an incredible book. It's worth spending your money on. Incredible games for developing communication skills and all the theater skills. But she left and came back to California. So I was kind of there, what am I going to do? So I was talking to him, Donald, and saying it seems to me that all of our Western knowledge is kind of lacking in terms of what we're coming in contact with from Vietnam and these Asian contacts like that. And so he agreed. He said, yeah, it's true. I said, well, why are you doing that? If you think it's like kind of short like that. And he said, well, because this is how I make my money. I don't have to agree with everything. And he said, basically, this is a career track. You get your PhD, and you become postdoctorate, assistant professor, associate professor, full professor. He said, you're lucky by the time you're 50 years old, you can start doing something you want to do, individuals like that. So he suggested, take some time off. Look at some other things in the world, other ways of knowing things, give it interest. If you don't find anything, you can come back and make money. Okay. So I was an actor with the Second City for a while in Chicago, one of the improvisational theater troupes. Then I got a black belt in Okinawan karate, like that. And then finally I came in contact with this tradition, which is Bengali. I haven't got it here as a map of India. So you got Delhi in the center. And Gujarat over here, and this side is Bengal. So India is not a country, it's a subcontinent. Just like you have Italian people, German people, French people, different language, different food, different dress. So India too, where our Bengali tradition is more very intellectual, maybe more musical. And so one person said that Bengalis are the French people of India. They're a little arrogant, like that. So anyway, in 1974, I became a monk, and since then I've been satisfied, following this tradition. Let's see what else I got here. Okay. And so I work with various organizations. We have a Bhakti Vedanta Institute, which is especially working in the hard sciences. And with that, we organize international congresses with Nobel laureates George Wald, Charles Townes, Dalai Lama. Sir John Eccles, many Nobel lawyers participating in publications. But that's more like the hard sciences, And for me, it's just too boring. It's just too much. We had one congress on, First International Seminar on the Study of Consciousness Within Science. Now the University of Arizona has one, but they had to admit that they weren't the first. So we had several Nobel laureates there. And it was one of the most tedious things I've ever heard in my life. One of the questions was consciousness one of the elements of the array of the state vector at the origin of the universe? Right? Yeah, and it was like a ponderous way to deal with. So I would say myself, by nature, I'm kind of like a cultural anthropologist. That's where I kind of fit into like academic thing. So anyway, Donald Campbell said, if you find anything in the Orient, come back and tell me. Okay. So I found something, and here we are. Come back to tell you. So far as my look at the whole thing and lecturing on this a lot, making presentations, and now formal presentations, because in Peru, they're very seriously looking at different philosophies of nature, how to view nature. They don't have to accept the West. The biggest difference between the Occident, us, and the Orient is that the Occidental view of nature is... Oh my God! What's happening here? There's bottom up, right? And the oriental nature, view of nature is top down. Okay, I'll explain that. And for our definition of what is the oriental philosophy of nature, we're taking the Bhagavad Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam, which probably, you know, scholars will argue about anything, but probably we're going to find that Srimad Bhagavatam has a pretty, you know, universally accepted view of oriental view of nature, like that. And there are many, many descriptions of science in the West, right? How science developed over the from the Greeks on through different people like Bonaventura and different people in the Catholic Church. It came through the Catholic Church, really. So we like very much one very nice presentation by Harvey Cox. He's a professor from Harvard. And he said he had a nice essay called Science, The History of Science and Religion, A Lover's Quarrel. Like that. Sometimes science says to religion, I never want to talk to you ever again. Like that. And they both know they can't live without each other. You know? So kind of intuition and rationalization. We can look at it that way. Intuitive side of life and the rational side of life. And of course, right away, when you put it that way, you understand that really, you got to have some kind of synthesis. You have your own domains like that, but it's different. So many, many good books in this area. And this is, you know, we trying to take a standard view of also of development of knowledge in the West also from, you know, from different sources. Okay, so looking at it this way from Harvey Cox, other people, sometime all these alchemists, you know, and Paracelsus and Magnus, they were developing the basic ideas of what is science and how do these things, you know, go on like that. And sometime, a long time ago, there was this big war. Who was going to occupy the throne of reason? Was it going to be the mechanical philosophers or the chemical philosophers? And it went on for a long time. And finally, the mechanical philosophers won. So chemistry, you know, became known as alchemy in its origins. But people make it the point that at that time, the mechanical philosophers and chemical philosophers were both, from modern view, this is screwy, this is crazy about what is reality. But somehow the mechanical philosophers won. And so then
we have this hierarchy. Where I go, flash there, okay.
So physics became the normative science. Yeah, and everybody has to explain something in terms of physics. For example, chemistry. What is the most scientific definition of water? Yeah. You have to go back to a physical formula like that to explain what is water. You have to go to sp3 orbitals and explain your chemicals have to be explained, really, if you want to really make them justified in terms of the physical basis like that. And of course, biology. I have some very, very potent medicine, but do you think the FDA is going to allow you to release it on the market if you don't know the chemical formula? No, you've got to know the chemical formula for that drug before they're going to say, okay, we're going to release this like that. So this is hierarchy. You know, biology has to be justified in terms of chemistry. Chemistry has to be justified in terms of physics. Psychiatry is based upon our biology, neurons, you know, transfer from these things, all these things. And then, you know, I have many friends. One is a psychiatrist. If you're actually dealing with, you know, some difficult situation, your team will consist of a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and social worker, right? That's kind of the integrated model now. The problem is actually we have to look at it from a social environment, psychological environment, and psychiatric environment. But who's the guy in charge of the team when it comes down to the actual decisions?
Psychiatrist.
Yeah. So psychiatry is more a real science than psychology. And then sociology, and then theology. So try and convince somebody that theology is a science like that. Yeah, even I talked to one physicist one time, and he said, "You know, psychology is not a science." And that was, so yeah, of course I know. So we ended up with this hierarchy, you know, in the West. This is trying to understand this comparison. This is one very important fundamental thing. Is in the West we have this view that matter is real. Right? Is it? Well, a physicist, of course, will say yes. You know, that's where you can start, you know, substantial. The Oriental view, top down. So here we have a hierarchy starting with the Adi Purusha, who we classify here as Govinda. And in terms of, like, how many people here know what Adi Purusha means? Okay, so give you an idea. Peter Pan. There's Peter Pan. And this is the idea of Govinda, always playing, having a good time, just, you know, so many wonderful things like that. And this is the ultimate reality. It's a very playful, youthful, ever fresh. And we see this in so many literatures, right? This idea of someplace like that, where it's always just fun, you know, things are going on like that. And this is the idea of the Adi Purusha in the hierarchy. From Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a pretty much universal classic, then he expands himself. This is kind of going to show charts here, as the Purusha avatars. Okay, so this is the transcendent level, but here we're starting to come then to the physical world, right? Physical world, philosophy of nature, and the Vedic culture. This expansion or incarnation avatar is called Yamaraj. You know, so here we have some pictures of the prison of hell, you know, and the prison warden. Purusha avatars are like that. And again, it's like when the prison warden goes home, he doesn't, you know, he changes his attitude when he comes into the house, right? He doesn't come in like, you know, why isn't dinner ready yet? Like that. Send my children to the hell. Like that, you know. room 107. Like that. You know. Yeah. So this is the same person, but he has this aspect of his personality which is for dealing with the material world, which is we'll get to later. And we find the same personality in Allah, or Jehovah. You know, the same controlling, dominating, you know, attitude like that. You know. So then after that, we come to Purusha avatars, some transcendental level. Next level, okay, is a psychological level, right, in this model. So to use an analogy to explain this, you're at a party, and it's very, very nice. It's organized for the fabulously wealthy and friendly Sri Govinda by his girlfriend, Radha. Okay? It's a beautiful swimming pool, ping pong, nice vegetarian food, vegetarians, Coca-Cola. You know? And everything is very nice, but it's all for the Adi Purusha, you know, all for God, like that. You know, God's a Sanskrit word. So somehow or other, you develop this egoism, right? This separate egoism, this narcissistic complex, and you want to turn away from him. And why should everything be for him? But it's his house, his girlfriend, his party, his friends, his swimming pool. So you turn away from everything, and what is it? What do you turn towards? And you have to go into some kind of catatonic, you know, schizophrenia like that, you know. So in one corner of the room, he's so kind, there's a black and white television set, right? So I got here now. And, okay. And so, what's on the television set? The Me Show! Okay, it's all about you! Oh! You know, they call it, you know, adventures and, you know, failures and successes. You know, come again tomorrow for the next version of the Me Show. So this is the first level, psychological level. And it's called Ahankara, or you might say reflected ego. You know, because the idea is you're turning away from the source, and now you're seeing a reflection of your ego. And basically, the idea is that all it does, it makes us identify with this external world. Like that. So kind of like glue. It has no real quality other than that, the Ahankara. But here, yes, everybody thinks we're in the room. Now, the final conclusion of this thing is we're not in this room. We're at a party with Govinda, but somehow or other we become absorbed in the Me Show. You know? So everybody knows the power of television, right? You're trying to do your income tax, you're trying to do your work, and there's a television going on in the room, you know, Lord of the Rings, you've seen it 4 times, but it's like, you know, you can't, you know. So the Ahankara has two potencies. One is the throwing potency. It throws you into the material, the prakriti, the material world. And the other one, it covers your intelligence like that. So you forget everything else like that. So this is the first one, the Ahankara. And this is common to the Buddhists, everybody, the same model, like from this point on. Okay, so I'm identifying with this you know, physical world, external world. And what we got here? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So, but in the beginning, the material world, the external world, is called pradhan. It's a non-manifested form, like that. It's just like some cloth or something like that, you know? But then, as we get more and more egoistic, more and more attached to it, then the Purusha expands himself, right? And enters into it, and, hello, how are you? Yeah. Yeah, okay. Hello, how are you? A puppet. Okay, yeah. Okay, so, yeah. So internally, by introspection, we're seeing the Purusha as, you know, the Sanskrit Paramatma, Super Soul. In Christian tradition, the Holy Spirit. In psychologists, from the psychiatrist within, guiding you. But by inside inspiration, you can come in contact with something there, you know, very like gamblers, you know. And people experience this as a reality. Gamblers live that way, you know, solely by feeling when it's right, when it's not, you know. So, very intuitive level at this point. So, so you got here. Yeah, okay. So then, externally, it's experienced as time. It's very good because I have a definition of time. St. Augustine said, time is a very simple thing until I think about it. Then I can't figure out what it is at all. What it is at all, like that. I mean, physicists, if you want to catch a physicist's attention to start talking about, oh, have you heard about time in the Vedas? This is like very attractive. You know? Lovers, everybody's interested in time. So in this model, time is the external manifestation of the super soul, the Paramatma. Like that, okay, yeah. Like that. Okay, yeah. So internally, if you look inside, by introspective techniques, you see this inside inspiration, intuition. But if you're externally oriented only towards the external world, then you're seeing the time factor. And time manifests itself in three different ways. Creation, maintenance, and destruction, like that. The basic definition of what is time. Well, things are growing, coming. Well, they're here, they're staying, you know, but they're going to go away. You know? Very simple definitions. So I just want to show what I have here. Okay. And then, the you know, the one source manifests as so many things, right? This is the unmanifested state. But from this you get to, for example, it's a very famous thing in philosophy, right? What happens to my fist when I open my hand? Does it still exist? Is my fist there? It's there in an unmanifested state. Yeah? Very subtle point. So pradhan is the unmanifested state of the prakriti. When the time factor agitates it, you get, you know, so many different things coming out of it like that. So we see here the same thing. Okay. So in the mode of goodness, the mode of maintenance, this should blink now actually here. Then the ahankara, when it's modulated by time, like that, in the mode of goodness, maintenance, we get knowledge. In the mode of passion, we start thinking about it. In the mode of ignorance, we get the gross body, the gross world, and gross perception, like that. So we'll go back over these. I'm still working on this here. Okay. Yeah. How do we get rid of the a ticket or what?
Click the little X.
Click the X.
Yes.
Goodbye. Okay. Okay. So the puppets are still there. Okay, so it's a black and white television set. We forgot the party. We're identifying with the me show. And now, at that point, you can get right back out. Wait a second. This is not a good. It's not a good trip, you know. But no, if you want to get more involved, then the Paramatma starts to manipulate things. And the first level then is buddhi. Buddha comes from the same word. It means knowledge, perspective. I'm watching the television show. It's a football game. It's the Bears versus the Tigers. Okay, you know. And that level, there's no desire. I'm just aware of things without any kind of particular desire. But I can know. And this is already a kind of rebellion, you know, an independent knowledge potency, right? You know, I can know independently. I'm an independent knower. I'm as good as God, right? It's already very subtle, but already to know is already a kind of rebellion. You see? Very subtle.
Okay, so what happens next? So then, next. Okay.
My wife, she bet $500 on this game, right? Her husband is a tiger, right? We're the bears. We got to win. I'm going to lose $500. Okay. So at this point,
what do we got going here? Okay.
At this point, I guess it's the cathexis in Freudian terms, or the chitta in Sanskrit. In the mode of goodness, it's in the heart. I'll give an example here. Carl Jung, he was in the Tavistock lectures. He talks about when he was visiting some Hopi Indians in the Southwest, 1937, 32, I don't know, something like that. And he was talking to them about their view of reality. And he said, you know, sometimes when I have different thoughts in my head, and all the Indians kind of like, you know, move back from him. And he said, well, did I say something strange? And they said, you said you have thoughts in your head. Only a madman has thoughts in his head. A sane man has thoughts in his heart. Right? There's a black poetess from South Africa, and she says, a woman thinks with her belly, a man thinks with his heart, and a white devil, he thinks with his head. How many white devils here? Or devilesses? Yeah? So our culture is very passionate. You say, where are you? You think, I'm here. You know? But this is a very passionate, goal-oriented analysis, measurement. His cake is bigger than my cake. How can I get his cake? You know, this is all in the level of goals, orientation. We're the bears. We got to win. I'm not satisfied just with knowing. You know? Now there's a past, there's a future, there's hopes, there's ambition. So the chitta goes from just being here, aware of my thoughts, aware of my senses, to the point of identifying, you know, with my thoughts and my activities like that. Okay? You want to get more involved in the me show? He says no. he knows the conclusion of the me show. Well, it's okay. Here we go. What happened? Oh, yes, I got hurt. Another example, one of my friends was a deep masseuse, doing deep tissue massage like that. And another from my wife, his friend, not my wife, one of my friends, Richard Weigel, his wife, had a debilitated hand, right hand like that. And she had neurophysiological tests, everything. There was no problem like that. So then she went to this girl and having the massage on the hand and this and that, and she's telling her, relax, let go, no, no, relax, let go, no, no, it's time, you're 22 years old, let go. So finally she relaxed and the tension went out and she started crying like a little girl, I didn't do it. And so then there's preconscious experience there. And when she was a little girl, her father died. And her mother had to go to another city to take care of the funeral arrangements. And she left her with her aunt, who was a little neurotic. And you can imagine what that's like. Maybe 4 years old with a neurotic aunt, with your daddy dead and your mother in a different city. It's like, and eating breakfast in the kitchen of something, some strange food. So there was one like Pyrex glass thing boiling on the stove, and it broke. So her aunt came in and accused her of doing it. She said, I didn't do it. So she took her hand and started slapping it and say, don't lie to me, don't lie to me. And she said, I didn't do it. You know? So it formed a traumatic experience, which she kept, you know, stored, right, in her gross body with the mind like that for all this time, waiting there until finally she was able to deal with it. You know? So trying to give this example of how the mind, you know, comes down to actually create or influence these lower levels. One last example here. In this model, the mind, we're talking about now, is like the business. And the brain is like the office. If there's damage in the office, it doesn't mean the business is destroyed. The business will recreate the office. The mind doesn't exist anywhere. You know, mind is, in this model, is a localized set of responses. The Buddhi is our perspective we have in life. We carry with us from life to life. You come in there with the Buddhi, the perspective, the background, the thing like that. And then on that basis, then we think about things, make decisions, activities, responses, build different, you know, networks of responses like that. But it doesn't exist anywhere. Yeah? It's okay? It's very subtle. You know, most people have a hard time with this. You know? But at this point, we have no physical world yet. Again, remember, we're not accepting the physical world as real.
Okay.
So time, finding in the Purushas, the psychological level. Now here's the gross level, the physical body, and the mode of ignorance. It's the bears against the tigers. You know, the tigers are eating up the bears. We're losing. I'm going to lose my $500. I have to go right down the field and help out. I have to put on my uniform. Number one. Okay. You want it. We're not forcing you. So then there's different kinds of physical bodies. These are all psychological bodies. You can have a psychological body, a body of knowledge, right? Body of thinking things. Remember our topic is how cats see ghosts, right? Okay. So the physical bodies, this is called indriya, the senses, physical body. There's five different levels like that. And each one's a subset of the previous one. So the first level is space, calm. Every body occupies space, right? Yeah? See, we got some more things here. Okay, space. Okay, yeah, it's going to... So there's, in this area, maybe you know, there's many, many good studies on cross-cultural studies of space perception, like that. The person I found that's the most enlightening so far is one, he's like maybe passed on even now, E.T. Hall, Edward Thomas, not extraterrestrial, E.T. Hall, like that. And he's from Northwestern University where I was studying. And many very good books, okay, show them later on, Beyond Culture, The Hidden Dimension, and very, very interesting studies in perception of space from different cultures. For example, if you're touching somebody else right now, raise your hand. Even over there, they're not touching each other. Careful. Okay. I need you are too, if you can. Yeah. You can ask this question in an audience, packed audience of 150, 200 people, and maybe three couples of people will raise their hand like that. So this is our typical American industrial society space, right? In a traditional Arabic culture, if you're a traditional one, if you want to talk to somebody, you've got to be close enough to feel their breath on your face, right? Try that in Houston. Try that in Houston and see what happens, yeah. Indians who come from India, usually they discover very quickly that you stand a little bit farther away, right? Otherwise, people say, Rajiv, could you stand a little? I know it's your Indian, a little bit farther away. You're going to make people feel uncomfortable that close to them. Okay? So in every culture, there's this private space, which we don't think about again. This is the booty, the intelligence. We generate a certain space. And I don't know, America's about like this, right? Yeah. So if I enter that private space, British a little bigger like that. Yeah. If I enter that private space, it means one of two things, right? Either violence or romance. Yeah? You're telling somebody, you know? Yeah? Yeah. So it's a very subtle thing. It's invisible. It's invisible. But we create this. The other person I use is Marshall McLuhan. You see, I'm post-dinosaur age here. And they talk about, for example, in New York, they have these high buildings going up with steel, girders. And Iroquois, I think, one group of tribal people there, they're very used to walking around on these things, it's like 20 stories off the ground, like that. Do you ever go up on a ladder, one story off the ground or something like that? How do you feel?
Depends on how well it's...
Bound and tied down. So this is like 20 stories off the ground, So then they talk to each other, they toss tools to each other, sit down, have legs hanging, have lunch. So when you ask them, aren't you afraid when you look down? So their eyes are riveted on your face, and they say, I never look down. Yeah. So my eyes now, right? Can you feel them?
Can you put mine?
Yeah. So, generally, many times, European men are considered more sensuous than American men to American women because they use their eyes in a more tactile sense, like that. So this is a whole area in psychology. There's so many nice studies to show this, even this hierarchy. And before you, whenever you see, whenever you feel, I'm going hierarchy, so, touch like that. then a part of the space becomes identified with a certain texture, mass, and then finally you get visual. So our society is extremely biased towards visual perception, like that. Different studies. You can go on. You know, go to your library and look at, just put the keyword in visual perception. How many books do you have? You know, 140,000. How many do you have on acoustical perception? 14,000. Extreme bias towards visual perception. But in Marshall McLuhan has the same hierarchy. He's saying that tactile and acoustical, which is where space comes from, are more subtle than visual, but he hasn't got this hierarchy of the two like that. You know? Many things. There's one book I'm trying to find. I have the wrong title. I think it was called Mind Works by Max Ernst. And he talks about, you know.
Why is our society biased towards visual perception?
I don't know. You know?
Well, could you give us an example then, at least?
Right now. Close your eyes.
Right now?
Yeah. And we'll go on with the lecture now. I keep your eyes closed. It's like, right away you feel like, you know, I'm not oriented properly, and you know, you feel nervous. You know. I'll give you. Okay. So there are many studies in this, like in specific things like that, in the area like that. And very good books on reference again is E.T. Hall. It's very good books. They're in reprint. And Marshall McLuhan. In MindWorks, he talks about sequential event discrimination. Two flashes, or two tickles with a little electrode, or two clicks. So we would think, oh yes, well, vision is the finest, like that. But no, it comes out that tactile perception is three times faster, finer. You know, at a certain point, 1/25th of a second or something like that, two visual events start to merge. If it's closer than a 1/25th of a second apart, you start to become one event. And so with tactile, it's about three times finer. You can distinguish down three times finer. The hand is quicker than the eye, right? And then finally with sound, even three times finer than touch. A human being can make a half cycle per second discrimination at 2,000 cycles per second. 2,000 cycles per second, you change the sound one half cycle, a human being can perceive that. So sound becomes very extremely sensitive thing like that. You know? So a portion of the sound is then identified as touch, a portion of that is identified as vision. One psychology experiment, these psychologists are always very, you know, what's the word, like, you know, cunning people like that. So these chemistry students were invited to come in for the psychology experiment. They sit there, and there's a Kel-Doll apparatus. You know what a Kel-Doll apparatus is? It's a big thing with different kinds of flasks, with tubes, where you can bring together different kinds of chemicals and stuff like that. And it's all made of, you know, of course, very, very highly crafted glass, and it costs, I don't know, nowadays, maybe $2,000 or something to manufacture anything. So sitting on the desk, and these are all graduate psychology students, they know this, you know. So the experimenter says, oh, we have an experiment today, and he accidentally knocks off the Kel-Doll apparatus on the floor, right, like that. Now, every single graduate psychology student levitates about 2 inches off their seat when this happens like that. Because they know this is like, you know, $2,000 in glass crashing down onto the floor like that. But it's not glass. It's made of plastic. So it kind of bounces and the guy puts it back up again. So they were seeing that as if it had a certain tactile nature to it. You see? So this is the point. We can investigate this correspondence to Western psychology. Yes, whenever you see something, there has to already be a tactile assignation to your vision. And beyond that, it has to be space before you can see. Right? So it's a hierarchy. And again, this is not, we're saying this is the way reality is. These people are not just like, they're walking around in these girders and stuff. They live in a different space than we do. It's not just like they're thinking about it that way. You live in a different space, yeah.
So, following up on that question, mm-hmm. does it mean, I see the difference when I'm in the U.S., I'm more visual than when I'm in India.
Yeah.
So, like, is that something about the environment that makes
Different cultures have different inclinations, and that's why cross-cultural studies are so nice. For example, in India, can you drive your car without a horn? Yeah. Can you?
No.
Yeah, it's that extreme, you know. Because when you're passing somebody, you start communicating with the horn. I'm behind you here. I'm coming closer. You know, it's much more. And for example, in India, how do people read newspapers in India? One person will buy a newspaper. They go to the tea stall, sitting there, and he'll, you know, everybody else will listen, like make comments. It isn't like everybody. One monk came into the monastery, and he was scandalized because there was another monk reading a book, and his lips weren't moving. Yeah, it was like he was reading without talking, you know, like that. It was like the psychological, it was like some kind of dirty thing. Reading the newspaper. So it was a very acoustical culture oriented towards sound communication. So according to our analysis, it can be a more sophisticated culture in terms of communication and ideas like that, exchanges. And it's easier for the mind, actually, to store information at this level in terms of sounds. I think I'll come back. Let's go down. Let's finish off here. Then gustatory, you know, tasting things. These all correspond to different elements, different devatas. Finally, olfactory. Our dog, what is his inclination? Yeah. If he comes into his house and somebody put a full floor-length mirror there and he sees a reflection of himself, you know, who's this dog in my house? His hair stands up. And he smells it. Oh, it's an illusion. Right? So your dog wants, you come home, your dog wants to see if it's you. He smells you. You know, it's Bob. You know? And then this can confirm that, you know, yeah, it's Bob. You know, like that. You know? Cats have two sets of noses, right? They have the ones here, and then right behind the front teeth there are also two more olfactory perception glands. And then for producing fragrance, where do they have their glands?
Actually, they have some glands.
Yeah, behind the ears, somewhere there, and on the tail. So when your cat's rubbing his head on you, it's not just affection, he's actually rubbing some odor on you. Yeah. So later on, you know. Yeah, when there's so many things you can see like that. Different animals have different perceptions, different levels like that of consciousness. Different bodies have different combinations of these elements, space, mass, fire, vision. These correspond directly to, earth, water, air, no, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, or space, like that. And for each of these, there's a personification predominating like that. So it's a very sophisticated, you know, development. Okay. So here's these Marshall McLuhan. The media is the massage. And E.T. Hall, Hidden Dimension Beyond Culture. Yeah. Okay, so our final point. So we've already had the level of space, and now we're coming to the level of mass. So in my karate studies, you know, Okinawan karate, Oichiru, is our school sign there. I only got a first degree of black belt, and I became a pacifist after that anyway. You know? So, actually, my instructor took me aside one time and he said, "Okay, I'm not going to tell the other students, but I'm now going to teach you the most ancient and most effective form of self-defense. It's not kung fu, it's run fu." So, run for your life. Yeah. Okay. So, but they could fill this here. Yeah, the third degree of black belt. This is dangerous. This is more dangerous. This is the most dangerous if you can maintain it. So in my school, third degree of black belt could punch through this straight like this, no calluses or anything else like that. Just punch straight through it. I feel it afterward. Very like that. So it seems miraculous. You can't explain this. So many things like that, but it's all because of concentration of the prana. There's a whole science at this level how to do this. For example, we had to sign an oath. I will never reveal the secrets of the Uichiru Karate School. I didn't sign the oath. It's before that. And it's kind of preliminary thing was to have like an electric fry pan full of sand, and you pass your hands over it. Okay. It's like that one time. But you practice. concentrating the prana, the tactile energy, and you can see it's different. You can actually feel it's different. You can't see it. So when I was doing this one time, I had a cat. His name was Mr. Cat. And had an interesting history. So he was sitting here, like looking this way. So then I was trying to like shoot the chi, the prana, chi, prana, out of my hand, like that. And he could not see my hand. And it wasn't the heat. The distance was far enough away. But he actually turned around and grabbed my hand and bit it, cut it out. So I waited. And I did it again. He bit my hand harder and ran away, like that. So yes, he could perceive the tactile energy. Cats are very tactile. If a cat is being chased by four dogs, he can jump, damn high to escape it like that. So anyway, the prana is invisible. So cats are very tactile. So I had one friend, he was in New Mexico, with his girlfriend. She was a tribal person. And he told me, they were sitting on the sofa, and she said, there's a ghost moving across the room. So he told her, cut it out, And she said, you don't believe me, do you? And he said, no. And she told him, look at the cats. So these cats were on the floor, like that, side by side, at the foot of the sofa. And he said, and a picture here, that their heads were moving like this, just side by side, like
they were watching something.
Yeah. But both of them, it's completely parallel, watching it move across the room like that. So they're not seeing the ghost; they're feeling it, right? In the Vedic culture, there are bhutas, pretas, kushmandas, vinayakas, vayakshas, rakshas. All these different kinds of beings on these different levels like that. And so, for example, Gandharvas, what we translate into English as fairies, probably Rakshasas are probably trolls from our tradition, like that. And so some of them have, are attached to their mind and intelligence. For example, you die in great anxiety, because you're a miser, a horrible, dirty house, and you die. So someone comes into the house, they buy the house, they're cleaning it up, and they notice that there's a loose floorboard. So on the psychological level, this is going around, and you're still hanging out there, you're attached. You're very somnambulistic. Who am I? What's going on? Oh, they're going to find my gold. So you start attacking them somehow or other. Choking experiences, things like that. And then more gross, maybe they're another kind, another species. They have a physical, called tactile covering, tactile level like that. So then you can feel them. Well, they're localized in space, but you can't go on like that. So they're different species, just like we have cats, different kind of energy in the cat body, different kinds of perception, and human beings like that. So this is the whole model.
I think it's the end of the program. Oh yeah, okay, so I would summarize again. Occidental is bottom up. Physics, chemistry, biology, psychiatry, psychology, and sociology and theology. God is a wonderful invention of the evolution of human society to protect us from fears of the unknown after thousands of years of evolution. Right? Oriental is the Purushas, the psychological levels, the physical levels. And there I am. Okay. Thank you very much. Please knock those stones.
Okay. So that's kind of what we've done so far for San Marcos. And I'm trying to do some, it's like a run through. I'm trying to add on some appendices afterwards on specific topics like that. Anybody have any questions now? Anything? Or comments?
Yeah, what was the past in front of the cats?
The ghost. But see, this word ghost is kind of like general words. Some kind of entity. No, some kind of entity with its mentality. And many of them, on our level, it's a very gross level. And so therefore, most of these beings don't want to hang out here, or they're looking for certain things. So entity's there. He's there. He's identifying with his intelligence, who am I, what's happening. He's identifying with certain thoughts, and he's also identifying them with a certain space. And it probably means a certain kind of species. You get that kind of body by your karma. And so therefore he's wandering around looking for somebody who's intoxicated and smoking cigars to try and make a deal with him or something like, you know, hey, something. You know. American Indians, for example, have this tradition. I know every year they do an intense, like, you know, austerity program to try and get one of these people to become a partner like that. And sometimes it's a very ghastly, devastating relationship. Sometimes it's very lucrative, you know, for both sides of the bargain like that. So it's a, my one of my friends is a psychiatrist, Indian. He said most of my patients are haunted, my psychotic patients. They have some kind of problem like that. He said, but if I even suggest that in this Western environment, they'll put me in the mental hospital like that. But so here's a different view, you know, Oriental view, which incorporates, I guess I'm trying to present it, it's very rational. You can go ahead and start cross-correlating. I have so many other citations, you know, to try and match up how that we have the same experience in the West about these things. You know? But it's just that because we start with this other view, it doesn't make much sense. You know?
Yeah. So do you see any synthesis that's been going on through history between the two Oriental viewpoints?
Do I?
I mean, this Occidental Oriental viewpoints, the top-down, bottom-up things, has there been synthesis over the centuries?
Oh, boy.
What's the present state?
No, so I got to kind of stop and go through my data, my booty here, you know, like that. In my experience, and other people are probably much better, yeah, sure there are, I mean, many people are much better historians of science, you know, than I am. Who's the guy? He's a French, famous, René Guillon. He was a kind of a pretty popular writer, French guy. And his point was that because of this development, the West had lost its soul, you know. And he was trying to, like, create this synthesis. That was maybe not too long ago, in the 1940s, 50s. And finally he gave up and said, this is not going to happen. And he left and went east, you know, like that. He became a Sufi. He said, it's only going to happen when somebody comes from the West, from the East, and gives the West back its soul. In the history of Western development of knowledge and science, you know, readings like that, there's this whole development of physical materialism, you know, and the different choices were taken. So we're in, and people are starting to reconsider this now. Maybe we made some mistakes like that. So now I think there's, right now, there's a lot of bridges going on. But I think before it was a very isolated phenomenon. Maybe like Madame Blavatsky and the, you know, the Wheaton Theosophical Society or some things like this. The Vietnam War in that time was a very big, you know, encounter of these cultures. You know. And Peru, for example, where I'm working, where it's so successful, is because Peru is, I have one very good friend, he's a historian, he's in six different international who's who, Dimitri Katsikas. And he talks about countries of the middle ground that are in between the Orient and the Occident. He says Greece is actually like that. He's Greek. But Peru is like that because there, for example, like in Argentina, every corner there's a pizzeria. But in Peru, every corner is a chifa, there's a Chinese, you know, restaurant. And so there's a very, because the Inca and the pre-Inca coming down, this is somehow or other, there's a very Oriental, you know, nature, view of nature there. And they have the Inca culture, which would, this matches very well. You know. They have the colonial culture. They had Sendero Luminoso, which is a Marxist experience. And now they're really getting, you know, into the consumer industrial society orientation. So there they're in a position to look at all these things. So one of the groups that's supporting us is CONCETEC, Consejeros de Ciencia y Tecnología, and they set the educational policy for the entire nation, from kindergarten to postdoctorate. And so they're, you know, first round, they're very interested, you know, like that. But here is a philosophy of nature which, you know, allows us to do these things. But for, you know, there are ghosts and everything there, just you know, it's all the time, you know. There's a famous ghost house in Lima. The Sheraton hotels there, all these modern things, and it's just like typical downtown. And the bottom is like, you know, cigar store, lunch counter, you know, thing like that. And the second story is all this vacant windows. It's very famous, Casa Matusita, and the haunted house. So about 4 years ago, one reporter said, we modern people don't believe in ghosts. Peru has to come into the 20th century and, you know, become industrialized and cast off these superstitions. I'm going to spend the night in this place and you see nothing will happen. So next morning they took him out and took him to the mental hospital. Completely gone. I don't know how he is now.
I have a question.
At one point. So that was in a room like this with physicists down there, just, you know, physicists. And this, I asked them, would any of you pass the night in Casa Matusita? You're all physicists. Physicists are smiling, you know. The gringos can talk about, you know, physical nature and stuff like that, but let them come here and also see there's other side to reality. The Ayurvedic medicine system, the indigenous medical system, which is based on the same model, is just as useful and just as prominent as the Western medical system in Peru. The two go on just simultaneously, just as well. Yeah.
Okay, in your opinion, since Occidental cultures deny physical nature, what do you think we lose?
No, they don't deny it. Mm-hmm. But see, again,
the superstitions, I mean.
Huh?
They deny superstitions.
Well, superstitious means beyond sense perception. Mm-hmm. That which is superstitious.
Okay.
So, I mean, our words are superstitious. We can't see them.
Okay,
and it's a very, very, it's very, very, very more rigorous. You know, you mean Occidental cultures?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, what do we lose?
But one thing is, I would say, my background is it's a very poor understanding of the mind as a non-physical entity. The common model is that the mind emerges from the neurophysiological activity. That's the common model. You know, even Eccles and other people talk about a non-physical mind, but it emerges as their idea. It emerges and becomes something separate by itself. You know? But here's a model where the mind is actually, you know, the person is using the mind to access the gross body, like that. Yeah. And in the yoga schools and so many things, so many, you know, investigations, accepting the mind as that, then you get so many investigations. Then the mind can exist after the gross body is finished. I don't know, I mean, my experience, if you start talking to the most psychologists who deal with psychotic people and everything else, are inclined to accept that a lot of traumas come from a previous life. And you know, sometimes it's just many of some stories like this have been telling me, put it into movies and stuff. You know, I mean, one girl, she had one terrible trauma when one relative, when she was a little girl in a green room. It was so horrible she couldn't face it. But it was obviously because it involved things, elements that were from this lifetime. And so psychiatrists were trying to get her, the psychologist, to face it. And she almost came to the point of facing it, and then the phone rang. Psychologist took it up, turned around, she was gone. She was in her living room under the piano, completely autistic, and never came back again. So the movie finishes off. What did that monster do in that green room? So it was a trauma. I mean, maybe not, who knows how many lifetimes. Something so bad or so good, you know? Yeah. So we lose that. You know, a non-sensuous mind. Yeah.
I read a book by Brian Weiss on, he's a psychiatrist in LA. And
he's our friend.
Talks about past lives, but before being in the town, in spite of my Indian background, I find it very incredibly believable.
Yeah. There's also, of course, one of the biggest, most famous researchers is Eon Stevenson. And he's at the University of Virginia, and he's in charge of some, you know, division of the Department of Psychology for, testing psychometrics or something. He's a very reputable guy. Not only him, but he has several, you know, professors, doctors working under him for many years. And he's done very, very, hard statistical research.
So we know now a little bit more incontrovertibly that past lives does happen.
There's a whole thing about Buddhi and everything else. You know, science is knowledge for knowledge's sake. Forget it. Science is motivated. Right? This is our point. We're going back here to these higher levels. Behind the mind, finding the soul, the essence of the soul is saying is motivation. It's a very subtle pointing into the scientific methodology is aiming towards this knowledge, what we call gyan. But then this model says, no, behind that, it first comes motivation. First, you have a motive. That's the fundamental existential nature of the soul, is to love. You know, and so when this love is going to be for something, it may be perverted. You know, it may be a fundamental it's a fundamental narcissistic complex in which the soul has become both the object and subject of its own erotic potency. At that point, you know? So then you're going to develop a certain knowledge, you know? So again, scientific explanation of something is, you know, our motivation is not, I would say we have a motivation to kind of avoid this. It's my, you know, point. So it's going to be difficult to get funding and people are going to support it. Like that, yeah. It's going to work.
I'm Nigerian, and my mother, she has some relatives who still practice, you know, pagan faith in the western part of Nigeria. But there's something she told me about the way people kind of like visualized or even thought of generally like what the mind is. And she said that it was kind of an entity that kind of worked beyond you and worked towards you, instead of, you know, the Western kind of like perception of it where you think it's centralized in you and it works outward. So I thought that was pretty interesting, just because, you know, like if you just stand and look around, usually you're just like being receptive to things that are moving about, other objects, you know, movements about you, and that kind of crystallizes in you and you react to it. So I don't know, I think it's just kind of weird how there might be a difference, you know, between westernized, you know, perceptions of the mind and, you know, otherwise.
No, I was writing this thing that says, you know, now let's turn the globe west, and I think, why is west? Let's even just turn it south. Because pretty much this predominating idea comes from, I think, Northern Europe, from a cold, you know, metal environment fighting with nature. And that's our idea of reality. But even you go to the sub, you know, to more tropical climates and everything else, it's not just going oriental. It's also you go to South America, you go to Africa, so many places. There's different, traditionally different, you know, technology, you know, psychology like that. You know?
Well, in the language, she told me more of an indigenous form of Igbo. She said that the way people actually talk it, like if you say that, you know, it's windy outside, you say like this version, like the wind is, you know, brushing up against me today. It's not like, I think it's windy, it's what the wind is doing to you. So
ours is very, very ego oriented.
It's very egocentric. But it's just weird, just kind of like trying to perceive.
Where are you pointing? Where are you pointing?
Right here.
I mean, you start actually shifting, you know, the consciousness, you know, to the other levels, people feel very uncomfortable because you're taking them out of their range of like comfort perception and, you know, a tactile level. People, again, you start talking close to people like that. It's, you know,
How do, maybe this is for everybody here, some people, how do people from the East, Indian type of thing, people with this perception, who live here, how do they cope with the West?
There's a newspaper called, based a lot in San Jose, what was it called, Silicon India? Some kind of study like that. And Indians who come here, like, you know, usually, so they have three choices. Either become, start acculturizing, start drinking, associating with, in the office with the opposite sex, carrying on, things like that, you know. Or else go back to India, you know. Or else go crazy. Unless they have they develop another kind of community, a certain kind of community to you know, to maintain a certain perception like that. But usually it's kind of, you have this one choice, either become like the people around you or else just go back. And they don't adjust. But then, you know, I don't know, in modern people, what's it called, Mississippi Masala? There are movies about this, the community bringing these things about, how it's actually happening and how the community develops. This model, Sangat Sanjayate Kama, again, our egoism develops the idea of an individual psychology like that. I'm the master of my destiny. but even in Mexico, other cultures too, psychology is more a subset of sociology, right? Your social relationships are what really develops how your mind works, how you think. Your desires and ambition develop from the company you keep. So therefore you see that there has to be a community. And so Indians who come to the West are gradually, you know, building, you know, a new community, a new ethic, a new standard about what is proper. Divorce is becoming more common, just kind of accepted, you know. Like that. Whereas in India, if you tell somebody, "Oh, where's your sister?" "Oh, she committed suicide." You go, you know, but the same intensity. You say, "Oh, she got a divorce." It's like, you know, in traditional Indian group, it's like, "What happened?" You know, divorce is still like, you know, it's, you know, so, you know, stable. But in the West, it's becoming accepted. It's happening.
I was doing some social work kind of thing back in India, and one fine day when my wife came back from a trip and says, "Why are you trying to impose these solutions that you've learned in America into India, whereas there are Indian ways of doing Indian solutions that you should probably be more successful in India?" And that's when I realized that I'm probably more American than Indian.
Yeah.
Because I think in English,
yeah.
I speak in English, I don't use any of the Indian languages as much.
You structured
things.
So structured thinking.
Acclimatization.
Your structured thinking.
Right. Maybe the acclimatization to the U.S. is not so difficult. It's when I go back to India, I have a problem.
Yeah. Myself, when I go to Mexico, I feel at home. Raised in America.
Yeah, but American culture, I think, is very potent. You know, you can,
yeah,
in a sense, kind of smell American, you know, to another.
They're spatial.
Such a dense culture that
you just look at somebody, right? Again, their spatial orientation. I look at people in travel, I can see it in German, you know, Spanish, you know, how they're holding their body, their comportment, you know, like that, how they occupy space. Yeah, interesting. Very subtle, very subtle. Yeah.
I'd like to what the gentleman said here. And this goes to this is like an answer to your question. Basically, as far as I'm a student, it's very difficult to cope up with things that are here. But over a period, like right now, I'm still an entity of India because I'm in touch with my parents, my family, my friends who are as a group living here. But over a period, like let's say the generations to come,
yeah,
they are born and brought up here,
yeah,
so they are no more Indians, but they are Americans.
Yeah. Two generations.
But as far as I'm concerned, yeah, it's like more as 100% India is here. But if I stay here for a longer period of time, let's say 10 years, 20 years, then it's like 1% Indian, 99% of America.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of time and acclimatization.
You see, two generations, no?
Yeah.
I mean, your children are kind of like you, but their children are just like
people around.
Usually, many times the second generation can understand the language, their parents, but they can't speak it. And the third generation can't speak it or understand either one like that. Grandma is off like that.
Don't the religious communities keep teaching this way?
Well, again, see the word religion.
I mean, or the. Oriental view, isn't it taught?
Yeah, the word is Dharma.
Dharma, yeah.
But, because see what happened in the West, there was this Cartesian split.
Right.
You know? And in Dharma, there's no Cartesian split. This is religion and science.
Right.
You know? And so, there are the Buddhists, so many groups. They have their different, you know, traditions, like, you know, in the Hare Krishna movement, you know, the Gaudiya Vaishnavism. We have, you know, mostly now predominantly Indian membership in North America like that.
Well, it's like I'm asking him if you don't meet with people and stay in touch with your soul.
Pardon, you couldn't get to?
I said you don't meet and stay in touch with your soul. You don't. Well, the West needs what you have.
To be very precise that the emphasis is again on me. Right now, I am what I am. Separately, the friends with whom I interact with, be they Indians or American, I can share my thoughts with them. But as the generation will progress, like it's very difficult to have those things imparted to them, because they'll be learning in a high school that's in America.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Earlier, when we brought up superstition, and you said that was beyond central. Yeah. The cat's example of them being aware of these energy beings, that is sensual at a level that we just don't recognize.
Yeah.
And even in humans, we have a wide range.
Yeah.
Some of us that are called sensitives that can feel the presence of other people around us, and we may just say it's time to leave because somebody's in a bad mood.
I agree, but these hard physicists say, well, unless you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, any experience has to come back to an oscilloscope
instrument or
that you can see. Oscilloscope or pins moving across paper.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you can see these biased towards.
They can't. They don't accept people's witness, such as like say a healer. Works their hands, and I mean, feel it. I've been under hands.
Yeah.
You feel it, but they don't recognize your other people's witness of this. Yes, this is real. They don't recognize that as valid validation of there being something that's tactile going on.
Yeah.
Which is not superstitious.
No.
Because it is.
But from their point of view, it's superstitious. But from somebody else's point of view, it's not. I went one time in Berkeley, I was there. Is when Peter Ralston, Bloodsport, that movie. I got his name, Kurt Von Dom. This one person, he won the. Every few years in Asia, there's this kind of confidential international competition, and any kind of fighting style like that. And just, it's like it used to be full impact with no protective coverings, and deaths were common. So now they're holding the punches like that. So this person, Peter Ralston, won this a couple of years. One of the heaviest martial arts guys in the world. He learned Tai Chi from one kind of half-mad guy from New York, Chinese guy. And this guy would break bricks through tofu. He'd have like bricks with tofu on top. So it's understandable from this model.
Well, I have had an experience with having someone that's a very intense person, perhaps rather... maybe angry, big father image or something. Someone point in anger and pointing straight at me and very sternly.
Yeah.
And it literally feels like they're burning a hole with it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many people have had that experience, but that's not just my perception. I mean, it's something that is tactile.
Yeah. So different people are at different levels of consciousness and awareness. Say a couple more questions and we can.
I have a question.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. If you're brought up to believe most of the Occidental views that don't really encourage the sensation of the tactile experience, like she said, how do you move closer to feeling that, to being aware of it?
Okay, our program, I guess, come next week. I've been developing this over many years, a whole seminar program like that, And I did this with physicists and everything else. In the end, they're kind of like saying, well, maybe it's possible. So our next step would be then, let me go here. F5. I won't do it. Okay. Something's happening here. Anyway, we had this seminar program, and the next step was, and we're trying to organize next, is actually showing some applications in architecture, music, sound, like that. But the real next step is the following day, which is then Upadeshamrita Rupa Goswami. And he's giving a whole summary of these different levels, one is starting with this, with the psychological level, like that, going on up to the ultimate motivational level. So our approach is to go right for the root of the situation. that most cases, most people won't change and can't change because they don't want to change. And that's the real problem. Some people, it's just they don't have no experience of that. So they come in contact with that and they say, wow, and they can accept it like that. But in most cases, even ourselves, we have to really look at the motivation in terms of like accepting responsibility for different things and, you know, coming closer. So then what we're finding, he's coming to the conclusion is how to deal with this motivational level. And it's there in every tradition also. You know, it's maybe called religion, you know, religare, reconnect like that. And he goes into non-material, that the soul is meant to experience non-material ecstatic states. The mind is satisfied and there's an ecstasy. Piaget is talking about how the child sacrifices ecstasy and they become a rational being like that. Whereas children can fall into these ecstatic states, this becoming absorbed in playing or becoming absorbed in anger, where we sacrifice that, you know, depending on society. So that's our general suggestion is how, you know, to go right to the root of the problem, which is the motivation. And once the motivation starts to purify, then you can have so many experiences like that. You know. In terms of specific, you know, techniques and something, you can identify tools in terms of your particular area. You know, I have my particular nature, the way I'm doing things, so I've developed, I still do like some hatha yoga exercises and, you know, things like that, you know. And different techniques, things like that. We have specific techniques with mantra and meditation, we do like that, you know. And so, but from once you come to the top and you can see, oh, okay, these are the kind of, you know, this is good for me, this group, that group, this group. You can take your different techniques. But there's so many, you know, you just how to become more tactile. You can just start, you know, just become more conscious of it, just, you know, trying to touch people. You know? Yeah.
Don't you think emotional openness lies somewhere in that range between being tactile or not? Is emotional openness?
Okay, so emotion, the way we're defining it, is the ultimate inherent quality of the soul. Not rationality, you know. But then that manifests itself through different levels and becomes distorted and twisted, you know, so it becomes perverted, unhealthy at certain levels, or identified just with the body. You know, when I become hungry, I become angry. You know, I'm irritated all the time. Why is that? I give somebody a lunch and they're, you know. So it's just not a very deep emotion, profound emotion. It's just a bestial.
Well, I mean, it's horrible. We talk about that.
Yeah, it's like a level.
Tactile, actually feeling others' energy.
That's a little higher level.
And you've got to come up through emotional openness, and it's very hard.
Yeah.
Especially for a young person, because you're very vulnerable in romantic relationships and things, and we put that guard around our heart emotionally, and that if we don't go through that, then we can't reach this level of tactile sensitivity.
Yeah, so many things are caught up in your posture, and you know, you start becoming sensitive to that. Actually, it's pointing to your head. You start seeing. I notice people like, and they say, "I was thinking," or "I was thinking," or "I was," you know. So body, you become sensitive to body language, posture. What's the word? You know, inclination, tensions. So kind of stop here. Anybody has any individual questions afterwards? We're glad to talk about this. And this is kind of our, again, we're a lot of feedback. We're trying to organize this as a, you know, as a practical seminar, and then they'll organize and ideas if successful there. And probably we'll try and offer it at Vanderbilt University as an accredited course there, because that's our neighbor, you know. But it's basically trying to build bridges between these different cultural assets. Because I'm not saying that Western science is wrong. It's proven and very, very useful in many aspects like that. But it's just, you know, it has to have an integrated or integrated view like that. I hope next week is next Monday, because Tuesday is Valentine's Day. So we're having a...
When Jacob go.
next Monday is the program.
Yeah.
So next Monday, then we'll go over the other text, then, which is Rupa Goswami's, you know, discussion of high. That's more from the psychological specific. This is more like from the perceptual level than today. Now we'll go more to the psychological level, to the and especially to these more esoteric, what's the word, existential existential levels of the model like that.
It's here.
I don't know.
Next Monday.
Yeah. Here? Monday is not Tuesday, it's Monday.
Monday.
Are we not having classes Tuesday?
5 p.m.?
I know. 5 p.m.
Okay. So thank you all very much. Namaskar. Program.
Monday or Tuesday?
Monday.
Monday.
Hey, we're going to be sold. 19.